Good afternoon and welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson, Director of Friends of the Yale River. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Though it's only one of the Eel River's five major tributaries, even some North Coast locals think of the South Fork Eel as the Eel River. Even to those of us who count ourselves among its familiars, the Eel River is in many ways mysterious, even unknowable. The river comes together from a tangled skein of tributaries flowing out of a vast, rugged landscape. The Eel's relative obscurity has made it more difficult for river advocates to find support for the kind of restoration efforts we've seen on the Trinity and which are proposed for the Klamath. But the Eel hasn't always been so unknown, and it's about to get a lot more attention. Almost a century ago, the Eel River was celebrated as one of the best fly fishing rivers in California, perhaps on the whole West Coast, famous for the size and the fierceness of its steelhead and salmon. Today, California Trout, a statewide group focused on steelhead and salmon fishing and conservation, has embarked on a major campaign to educate its members, and Californians generally, about the Eel River's incredible potential. Our Eel River is, CalTrout suggests, the best opportunity on the West Coast for recovery of a major salmon and steelhead fishery. CalTrout's Eel River campaign is timed to help draw attention and energy to the Eel River, just as the door is opening on our greatest opportunity in a generation to change the river's course for the better. This spring, in April of 2017, Pacific Gas and Electric, better known as PG&E, will file the documents before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, that will formally kick off a five-year process to obtain new 50-year licenses for the two dams on the Upper Main Stem Eel River. Joining me today to talk about at least the most important pieces of CalTrout's work for the Eel River is Darren Maru. A fisheries biologist and hydrologist by training, Darren is CalTrout's North Coast Director. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Scott.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So maybe we could start by talking about CalTrout's mission, your role in the state generally.
Well, we actually have a new mission. It's about 1 year old. It's kind of a mouthful, but it reads, ensuring resilient wild fish in healthy waters for a better California. So we used to focus on exclusively trout fishing, and now we've expanded our mission to incorporate more ecosystem restoration scale activities. Our programs are statewide. We've got five regional offices and a central office in San Francisco. I'm the North Coast Director up here in Arcata, California, focused on our coastal watersheds from the Oregon border down to the Russian River, including the Eel River.
You guys have started a three-month campaign focused on the Eel River. Among the things I've seen so far are the new issue of your newsletter, the magazine The Current, which is focused almost entirely on the eel, and a five-minute film that's quite lovely, exploring the eel. Let's talk a little bit about that and what you're trying to do with this campaign.
Well, as you know, since I joined CalTrout, we've had actually a multi-year effort to bring attention to the Eel River.
Indeed.
And so focusing initially on bringing stakeholders together and trying to coordinate some level of restoration activities across the watershed, not just focusing on singular issues, but looking at each of them in detail and more broadly. You know, we began with many, many meetings discussing and focusing on the issues. In the meantime, with the Eel River Forum as a backdrop, we initiated projects in the Eel River estuary, several fish passage projects, and began focusing on the water issues as the drought set in and the cannabis cultivation activities really scaled up.
Yeah, and that set of issues has really come to a political head in the last few years, and you've been one of the key people, I think, I've seen, you know, helping all of us figure out what to do and what's going to work.
Absolutely. And so our strategy has been to take a headwaters to sea approach so that we can address each of the issues that are plaguing the Eel River, its salmonid populations, restoring wild fish abundance. And this campaign that we're embarking on in the next 3 months is really to bring attention to those activities, but leading up to this very momentous action that's going to happen in April with PG&E submitting for its FERC license.
So let's talk then about those Eel River dams and that why it matters that we're talking about relicensing them now.
And I really like the way you refer to that. You know, people aren't as familiar with the Potter Valley projects. It seems like something way out in the hinterlands, which it is. But the fact is the Eel River has two dams on it.
Yeah.
And they regulate flow and they have an interbasin transfer of water. So
tell me a little bit about that. Describe the two Eel River dams and how they connect to the Potter Valley and the Russian River.
Yeah. Well, they've been in place for over a century now. I think
1908 for the lower one, the Cape Horn Dam, right. And 1922 was the Scott Dam.
But I do know that above Lake Pillsbury, there's 288 square miles of watershed. It's the largest single area blocked by a passage barrier in the Eel River and in the North Coast, in fact.
Yeah, and that's almost 10% of the 3,600 square mile Eel River watershed, but is probably a more significant 10% of the watershed than many other 10% you might pick out as potential salmon habitat. Why is that?
Well, it's relatively undeveloped. It's mostly in Mendocino National Forest. A lot of that watershed's above 5,000 feet elevation, so you have cool water temperatures throughout the summertime, and it's currently inaccessible, but probably has abundant habitat.
When you say it's currently inaccessible, you mean to anadromous fish, sea run steelhead and Chinook salmon that we're mostly talking about in the mainstem eel. Of course, we've got other anadromous fish in the Eel River, lamprey, mm-hmm. coho salmon, sturgeon. But there are fish in the upper watershed, right?
There are omicus, resident rainbow trout.
Yeah. Yep. Uh-huh. And they're doing pretty well, and the water temperatures, like you said, are fairly cold.
So, as far as I know, they are doing just fine up there.
Yeah.
And in fact, probably holding on to some of the historic rainbow trout genetic material that might be important for reintroduction below the dams, should we get there.
And this raises an interesting question. Something that I think a lot of people are really not aware of is the spectrum of connection between what we think of as trout and what we think of as salmon. And the steelhead, which we've often thought of as trout, are kind of in the middle of that continuum. But
that's right.
Rainbow are steelhead and steelhead are rainbow. Am
Absolutely.
I correct in asserting that?
Yes.
So why do we call them different names?
Well, steelhead are rainbow trout that decide to go out to the ocean, and when they do so, they find abundant food resources, and they get big, and they come back to spawn in the rivers. And that's really the basis for the recreational fishing activity that's been so important in the Eel River, these wild, large fish coming back in the fall and the wintertime, and they're just amazing fish.
You know, that's a really good point. And, you know, I'm not a fisherman, really, and I'm not a fisheries biologist. But talking about steelhead, one thing we should flag is the summer steelhead in the Eel River. These are a relatively rare, but still hanging on, couple of populations of these fish that seem to be, well, unusually large and feisty and kind of extraordinary.
They are extraordinary. They're a different run than the winter steelhead, which is more common. They're a bit more tied into the snowmelt runoff,
mm-hmm.
so they're able to access higher elevation river channels and streams in the spring and summertime as the flows are cresting from snowmelt and coming down. We know that they are still abundant in the Middle Fork Eel River. I've been up there and seen them. It's really a tremendous place to go up there and see these large steelhead residing in, you know, the Middle Fork that's receded down to its summer base flow. But there are these giant pools up there carved from bedrock, and it's really neat.
Nice cold pools.
They're holding on.
Giant fish, yeah.
And my understanding is they're also hanging on to some extent in the Van Dusen
as
well.
That's correct, yeah. And the most recent counts we've seen are, you know, in the neighborhood of 100 or so fish coming back in those adults to the Van Dusen. But, you know, they're still there, which is kind of remarkable.
It is amazing.
Yeah. And there does seem to be a real parallel between the summer steelhead and spring Chinook. They're not the same fish, but they have sort of the same relationship to their base fish.
You know? They have a similar life history.
Yeah.
Like I say, you know, the swollen rivers in the springtime allows them to get up and over barriers that might otherwise occur in the summertime. And so they can get higher into the watershed where it's colder. So they can hang on in the summertime, then they come out to spawn in the fall.
But they spawn way up in the top of the watersheds where the water's cold and food resources are probably relatively abundant.
Yep.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. We'll come back to that. Let's talk about how those Eel River dams have affected salmon populations. We're talking about the habitat that is lost right now above Scott River Dam because there's no fish passage above Scott River Dam. But there is a fish ladder at Van Arsdale at the lower dam, the Cape Horn Dam. Why isn't that enough?
Well, the fish ladder over Van Arstel is significant because it allows fish to get up and over that dam and populate the 12 miles below Scott Dam.
Yeah.
But, you know, estimates are that there could be 100 or more miles of habitat above of Scott Dam. And so that could sustain a relatively large population of Chinook salmon, steelhead, and potentially coho salmon as well.
Mm-hmm.
The National Marine Fisheries Service recovery plan did document what they call intrinsic potential habitat above Scott Dam. And so it could harbor each of those species as a population.
But there's another problem as well, which is the way that reach between the dams functions. There's a lot of cold water coming out of that upper dam, which makes the river quite cold and hospitable for salmon. It's a good place for mm-hmm. them to be born and grow. But then it sure looks like they're not getting the signal they need to go out and down the rest of the river in time. So it seems like kind of a trap there.
That is exactly the term that's used. It's an ecological trap. They stay there into the spring time towards summertime because the water's cold, they're still rearing. But by the time they're large enough and ready to leave, to migrate downriver to the ocean, the conditions downstream have become hostile. Temperatures are too high. We know the Eel River is full of northern pike minnow, which yeah. prey on juvenile salmon and steelhead. And so their chance of success in migrating down the main stem Eel River is really low, I think, the further you go into the summertime.
Yeah. Let's try to give listeners a bit of a context for what we're talking about when we talk about salmon populations. What were the historic populations and how do we know in the Eel? I mean, I use a number of 1 million fish in an average year, but, you know, no year is average.
Right.
And what does that really mean in terms of what kind of abundance you would have seen in the Eel pre-European contact?
Yeah, well, it's an amazing story. Caltrout, a few years back, commissioned researchers from the UC Davis, Ron Yoshiyama and Dr. Peter Moyle.
Mm-hmm.
to look into what the historic abundance of salmon and steelhead was in the Eel River.
Actually, I think we helped pay for that one.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
We should add your name to the list.
I think it's on there.
Is it? Yeah. Okay. That's good to know. Sorry.
It's okay.
Thanks to the Friends of the Eel River.
Yeah.
Anyway, there isn't a lot of historical documentation about salmon and steelhead abundance in the Eel,
yeah.
but they dug up the cannery records from the late 19th century from the Ferndale.
When we had canneries on the lower Eel.
When massive we had giant canneries.
Yeah.
There's some amazing photographs out there, the historical photos of the cannery operations in the Ferndale Bottoms. But they essentially back calculated the number of adults that returned in those years where they captured them in the lower river based on the weight of the cans, the product that was shipped out of Ferndale.
Yeah.
And estimated for Chinook that in good years, up to 800,000 adults would come back. Steelhead, I think the number was 150,000.
That sounds right.
And coho, about 100,000.
Yeah.
So in the good years, probably over 1 million fish returned annually.
How does that compare to what we knew was in the river in the middle of the last century, you know, and what happened? Why did we lose so many fish and where are we now? That's a big question.
We wish we knew a lot more about current abundance. There hasn't been a lot of monitoring recently of adult salmon and steelhead returns to the river, but we do have some important information from the 1938 through 1975 Benbow Dam records.
Right.
During that period of time, there were still tens of thousands of fish coming back to just the South Fork Eel, so you could project across the basin and assume there was still a lot more abundant fish
right.
across the Eel River. What happened since then? Well, we had major floods. We had several eras of industrial timber harvest. We've had degradation of water temperatures. We've had overfishing, hatchery fish introduced into the Eel River watershed. And recently
we converted the estuary.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for reminding me. Yeah.
Yeah.
The estuary
is
tremendously important historically, and now it's essentially cattle farmland.
And we'll come back to that in a minute.
Sure.
But I think one piece that I try really hard to make clear to people is the chain of events and the fact that after World War II, when we saw the introduction of the bulldozer and the chainsaw to the logging industry, there were a couple of decades of very rapid cutting on slopes that hadn't been really accessible before. And so when the floods of 1955 and 1964 came in, it wasn't so much that those had never been seen before in the existence of the Eel. There have been even larger floods in the past. But
the land was just laid raw by this intense period of logging, and it wreaked havoc. Yeah. It brought down thousands and thousands of tons of sediment off the hill slopes, deposited it into river channels. Those conditions still persist today.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson with Friends of the Eel River, and I'm talking today with Darren Maru, who's the North Coast Director for Caltrout, and my colleague in a lot of Eel River discussions these days. You suggested a moment ago that we don't really have good records, but there have been a lot of suggestions recently that, at least with the Chinook populations and the eel, they're really rebounding. And I'm uncomfortable with some of those assertions. It seems to me that we don't really have that much reliable data. But as somebody who really is trained in fisheries biology, what's your take on the situation, and kind of are we at the low point now? Are we recovered? Where are we?
Well, let's take a step back and consider how big the Eel River is. So it is a really, really major challenge for fisheries scientists to cover this landscape and count fish. The eel is also known for incredibly large floods. And in fact, the flood of this January was the 21st largest flood in the record at Scotia, 258,000 CFS. That's just enormous. And so those conditions impose really challenges, big challenges to, you know, fisheries biologists to get out and count fish. And
not to mention the fact that you can't see through the water most of the time.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned, there was the Benbow Dam era. So if you have a dam and it blocks the fish, you can then capture the fish as they're trying to pass through a fish ladder.
Right.
And that is a really good record that we have. But that was decommissioned, and we don't have that structure anymore. We do have the Van Arsdale Fish Station, which is similar. It has a ladder, so the fish enter it. They can capture them and count them. And so those two fish facilities provide the best information we have contemporarily.
But that Van Arsdale fish ladder is way up at nearly the top of the upper main stem, so we're not getting
good information about the rest of it. You're missing a lot of river in between. Yeah. That's all right. So the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has a program in the South Fork Eel. It's part of the Coastal Monitoring Program, and it's the place where they are enumerating, they're attempting to count adult abundance by observing the reds and carcasses on the spawning grounds in the fall and winter time. And so they've been doing that for, I think, 4 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're getting data from there. But nowhere else in the Eel River Basin other than the Van Arsdale Station are we counting fish. There are new techniques out. There are sonar cameras that can be placed in the river. They take an image of the fish as it passes by. They're used in other rivers, and we would love to see that type of monitoring program put in place in the Eel River.
It'd be very exciting.
Yeah. And they're not that expensive either. It's really doable.
Yeah. We keep telling ourselves that.
Yes, we need to keep pushing for that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But where are we now? I'm pressing you to say again what I've heard you say before, which is that you think the low numbers are really in the 70s and 80s, and we're up from there. But do you still think that?
I think so. Going back to 2004 with the FERC license amendment for the Potter Valley Project, the reasonable and prudent alternative, the NIMS biological opinion increased the flow releases below Van Arsdale Dam. And I think beginning in 2004, we started to see a little bit of rebound in the fish counts at the Van Arsdale Station. And they peaked in, help me here, 2011 and 2012, I think we had.
Right before the drought.
Yeah, 2,400 and 3,600 adult Chinook come back to the Van Arsdale Station, which was the highest counts in many decades. So we were really encouraged then. And then, of course, we got into a major drought and the population returns have plummeted again. This year, they're not too bad, relatively. 400 and I think 35, something on the order of that,
which is
have come back.
Not terrible, but it's not great.
It's not great.
It's 10% of what we'd like to think would be a good number on the way up.
That's right, right.
So back to the big opportunity that we're all facing coming up in April. You know, the dam owner, the owner of the two dams, PG&E, is expected to tell the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that they want to keep those dams in place and they want a 50-year license to keep them in place. There are a lot of us, I think, who are going to say, no, we want those dams out. What would it mean to take those dams out? You know?
Yeah. Well, we hope we find out soon on the Klamath. But in the case of the eel, I think we're looking at it similarly. Caltrout's approach is to, first of all, determine what's best in order to restore salmon and steelhead abundance. Can we get fish up and over the dams, up into the watershed above Lake Pillsbury?
Yeah.
Or is it going to require taking the dams out? I think we don't know that yet, but we'll look at that. The other issue is, you know, how much habitat is available above Lake Pillsbury? It's been quantified in the past in some of the regulatory procedures with the project, but hasn't been done so very well. So actually, Caltrout commissioned researchers from Humboldt State University beginning in 2015 to start looking at that. We wrote a study plan, we funded a portion of the study, and then we obtained additional funds from National Marine Fisheries Service. So Allison O'Dowd in the Department of Natural Resources and her grad student Emily Cooper have been conducting this study. Emily spent last summer making many trips up to the watershed above Pillsbury, looking at habitat. We've got temperature data from up there now, and we'll be coming forward with the results of that study this spring as we lead up to the big PG&E event in April.
And there's another layer of uncertainty around this whole process now, because you and I and many other people have been looking at these basic questions of salmon abundance and restoring a river, and can we take these dams out, and what will it take to take them out, and what do people need to make it work? But we've always been thinking about it in terms of an existing process. And that process and the laws which put the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in charge of licensing dams say, among other things, that FERC at this point is supposed to consult with the natural resource agencies, the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, the U.S. Forest Service that owns the land around the dam, and it's required to condition its license on the protection of key public trust resources like fish, like cold water. And we've seen a lot of that stuff in the context of the Klamath Dam fight. A lot of talk about water quality. Those same issues are going to come up in the Eel unless, and this is the problem, the uncertainty, the Republican Party has been pushing very hard for a set of reforms to not just the FERC authorizing legislation, but also to a lot of the federal environmental laws, the Clean Water Act, the Federal Endangered Species Act. And we now have learned that our new president is likely to appoint some new commissioners to FERC. So is FERC our only hope here? Do we have to do it this way?
Well, it's going to come down to what PG&E wants to do first and foremost, because they're the dam owner, the owner of the dam.
Right.
But second of all, you know, if we are able to maintain the environmental laws that we have on the books, specifically the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act intact through the next few months or couple of years,
yeah,
those are the tools that we have to enable reform of a project like the Potter Valley Project. You know, I'm not a FERC expert, but it doesn't take one to understand that dam owners of dams would love to see the environmental laws that we have in place become weakened.
Yeah.
So they can fast track
their
projects.
And that's who's pushing those so-called reforms.
That's right. That's the risk that we face right now.
Right.
That we didn't anticipate perhaps a year ago when we were preparing for this FERC relicensing process.
But you're reminding me of a point that Craig Tucker, who's the natural resource consultant to the Cut-Oak Tribe and helped draft the Klamath agreements, made when he was sitting in that same chair here in the studio a couple of months ago. And he said, basically, you know, FERC is going to approve the decommissioning and removal of the Klamath River dams because the owner wants to take them out.
Right.
So it strikes me that there is probably a path through, even with a different FERC and different laws, if we can get to a place where people agree on the need to protect the river and restore it.
Yeah. And so we do know from recent past, when PG&E went through its license amendment process, that they actually considered selling the project.
They wanted
to step away from it. It's not a major winner for them. It's a small dam as far as hydropower capacity. What is it, 9 megawatts?
It's 9 megawatts at most, and only a fraction of that in recent years because of drought and the lower diversion rate.
Right. And we've actually been told by PG&E personnel that it's the project with the largest paperwork to megawatt ratio in the state.
That sounds about right. And if you stack up the output of those Eel River dams on a graph next to things like, the Shasta Dam or, you know, the other
you
know, you can't even see the bar on the graph.
That's right.
You know, it's just not
Caltrout even there. Was a part of the PG&E relicensing of the Pitt River projects. And, you know, those are putting out several hundred megawatts of power. It's tremendously different, right? Different context.
So another piece of this campaign is actually the work you're doing with Mad River Alliance and others around Steelhead Days. And that's stuff that's happening right now, has been happening the last few weeks. What's going on with that?
Right. Well, Caltrout is the Eel River sponsor for Humboldt Steelhead Days. We have two other partners. The Mad River Alliance is the sponsor for the Mad River. And then Mountain Community and Culture is the nonprofit organization sponsoring the Trinity River part of Humboldt Steelhead Days. And so this is our third year as part part of Humboldt Steelhead Days. We're really excited. It's grown this year. We got funding from the Humboldt Lodging Association to do a lot more promotions of the event, trying to bring outsiders in to enjoy this resource during the wintertime when tourism is typically low.
And we have had a great winter, at least with the rain. Yeah.
Well, each time the rivers come down to almost fishable condition, we get more rainstorms and they're driven back up. But yeah, we're hopeful they come down soon. I know people are out fishing on the Mad River because it's controlled a little bit more.
Yeah.
And they're able to catch fish there. So Humboldt Steelhead Days is occurring during January, February, and March this year. We already had a kickoff event at the Fortuna River Lodge in January. And we've also had two different field events leading tours of spawning grounds throughout the watershed. Those have been really successful. We've got a fine art showing coming up on February 4th at the My Type Gallery, just My Type Gallery on 3rd Street in Eureka. We've got a Peak of the Run dinner on February 11th. Caltrout sponsors the International Fly Fishing Film Festival, IF4. That'll be held at the Minor Theater on February 25th at 6:30. We had that 2 years ago in Arcata, last year in Eureka, bringing it back to Arcata, and that should be really fun. I hope
that'll be great at the
Minor
Theater.
A lot of people come out to that. Yeah. And then the culmination of Humboldt Steelhead Days will be into the Steelhead Season Awards Carnival on April 1, and that's at the McKinleyville Teen Center.
So if people want to see the film that Caltrout made about the eel or get a hold of that issue of The Current, how do they do that?
Actually, films. So we have a 5-minute feature video of the Eel River, and we have segments highlighting several of our project initiatives throughout the Eel River, and those will be coming out over the next couple of weeks. And they can go online at www.caltrout.org. You can also find our newsletter. It's called The Current. And The Current, it's a tremendous newsletter, really great, great information in there. Across the state, all of our programs are highlighted in there. In this particular Current, we're featuring the Eel River. The video you mentioned is embedded in there, so they can find all that information online.
Yeah, it's right there online. And there's some great stuff in there that we haven't had a chance to touch on, and we've only scratched the surface of the work you've been doing. But thanks again for coming on and for the work you've been doing, and onward.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you for having me. And thanks to your listeners for tuning in and enjoying our resource issues.
This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Scott Greason. I've been your host for the past half hour. I've been speaking with Darren Maru of Caltrout. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again on the archived programs page of the station's website at khsu.org. The Eco News Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Tune in again next week at this same time for the Eco News Report.